It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and it is definitely fall outside in Alaska. We sometimes tend to think of it as an in-between season when we're waiting for winter and the skiing, skating, and snow machine riding that is coming up, but that's a mistake. Fall lasts a long time around here these days. We can easily get 3 months of it. For in these days, it can be pretty mild. Plus, no one else is around. Folks quit outdoor activities, put away their boats, and hunker down. But it is not hunker weather yet, for the most part. You can still get out and have fun. Today I've got several segments on this theme. First off, I'll chat with APU outdoor educator Paul Twardock about the pleasures of fall. Then a guide from McCarthy talks about how to pack your bear canisters. They're especially important at this time of year. We also have an interview about boating safety classes. Now is the time to get your skills up when your boat is put away. We also have a couple of trail tales for you, including one about hunting caribou on a bicycle, only in Alaska. Stay tuned, it's all coming up on Outdoor Explorer. Well, there's a lot to do in the fall, and I have a guest in the studio now who's been with me many times in the past. Paul Twardock is a professor at Alaska Pacific University. He teaches about outdoor studies and becoming an outdoor educator. And he's been at it, what, for 30 years now?
At least, yeah.
Yeah. And as we're speaking, and we're pre-recording, but just back from taking 30 students to the Yukon River, and Paul's been all over the place. And what we were just chatting about, and what I want to talk to the listeners about, is the fact that fall is very underappreciated because, yeah, it might be a little bit cooler, but the bugs are gone. The people are gone. Maybe be careful not getting shot by the hunters.
Uh-huh.
But I mean, there's a lot of great stuff to do in the fall that is got a lot of advantages in Alaska.
Yeah, it's we're super spoiled this last couple of weeks. It's a little bit of a
We're talking like to people during 3 weeks of sunshine.
Right. Yeah, where when this airs, who knows what the weather will be doing? But right now, it's just, we've had the driest and warmest 3 weeks on record, really, since the 40s, I think, is what I read. So it's been amazing. But I would say, 30 years ago, when I started at APU and we would do trips in the fall, even 20 years ago, we would never really seriously considering long expeditions in the mountains. And if we did, we were prepared for, sub 20 temperatures, down to 0 degrees. Even 5 or 10 years ago, that you could regularly count on freezing nights. And boy, in the last 5 years, that just hasn't happened. So it's really open, for better or worse, it's opened up the fall for a lot of opportunities for in the outdoors.
Yeah, that's very true. And there's some assets that you have. I mean, the big one for me is absence of insects. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could literally sleep under the stars at this time of year if you were in a warm enough bag. And it does get chilly at night, but it's not that big a deal. I mean, we're used to camping in the winter. You can certainly camp in the fall, and you'd be pretty much free of bugs. And like, look up at these spectacular stars. I was just looking at the aurora at my cabin the other night, and I mean, it was one of these wonderful nights where we were grilling on the beach, and then we eat dinner, and then we got a couple of bottles of wine, and we were like, no reason to go inside, watch the sunset. Then these amazing stars come out, and you just think like, okay, this is perfect. And it's not, you're not used to seeing the stars, right? I mean, you see them in the winter when you're out skiing or something, but you're really not used to seeing them when you're backpacking or kayaking or something.
Yeah, I think I was going to say the aurora, to me, is the big advantage of the fall.
Yeah.
And I would say that fall it's yin and yang, black and white. It's either really, really nice
or
it's
hellish.
Really, really ugly, one of the two. Because when it's ugly, it can be really ugly.
Yeah.
And we sometimes forget that. And also we forget when it's really nice out, or when it is ugly and rainy and windy and stormy out, how quickly else and 2 days later it can be super nice.
Yeah, you got to be opportunistic about it for sure. It also can be unbelievably beautiful. You know, some of the drives I've had on the Glen Highway, going through, past Matanuska Glacier or down the peninsula when those yellow leaves are out, and the dark green conifers behind them. My gosh, that's gorgeous.
Yeah.
And that's like some of the prettiest you ever see Alaska. Now, granted, it might be like raining continuously, right? So it's easy to forget that, but yeah. Well, as Alaskans, we say you just need better rain gear, right?
Yeah, better rain gear. I will say that technology has really helped a lot also. I remember back in the day where mm-hmm. we would stand around in our cagoules and our leaky rain jackets and sort of suffer through it. And now, you know, you can buy these super lightweight teepees and shelters that and tents that make life really very comfortable. Mm-hmm. We use a big teepee called a kefaru that sleeps 12, has a wood stove, and the whole thing weighs about 15 pounds.
That's right? Amazing.
And it's still nylon. And boy, we were on the Yukon a couple weeks ago with APU, like you mentioned, and we had pretty bad weather. It was nice down here, but up mm-hmm. there, it was rain. It rained quite a bit. But boy, at the end of the day, you got in off the river and popped that teepee up and put the stove in there. And within 15, 20 minutes, you had a zone that was dry and 60 degrees. And so all of a sudden, you're in the zone of warmth.
Yeah,
and
that makes a big difference.
Yeah, it really does.
Well, the other way to do that is to get a public use cabin.
Yep.
And mm-hmm. again, that's something that is so much easier in the fall. It's crazy. I mean, if you want to get one of the National Forest Service cabins or state parks cabins, like in Prince William Sound for the summer, you better be on that website the first second it becomes available 7 months earlier, right?
Yeah.
But in the fall, it can be relatively easy. Midweek, you're almost sure to be able to grab one.
Yeah, and even on weekends, it's something that I think us Alaskans don't think about a whole lot because they are so difficult to get. Mm-hmm. That it's not even on our radar, but we've been looking at, my wife and I have been looking at when some out in Prince William Sound, like, oh, wow, they are, at least a couple weeks ago, fairly available. Now, the catch with that, Charles, is hunting. So places where, and periods when there's hunting going on, those cabins will get booked up mm-hmm. fairly far in advance.
Yeah. And I also think there's a certain amount of good sense in choosing where you go. I mean, I wouldn't go hiking out in the Sioux Flats on September 1st, right?
Right.
It's like, you know, you might as well go to the Mekong Delta in 1968, Delta, right?
Yeah, with the duck season. Right. Yeah, well, we had a group just finish up hiking through the Chugach, and, you know, sure enough, right up by Ship Lake Pass, there were some sheep hunters, and the hunters came over and said, hey, you know, we're hunting here. Do you mind? And our group was sort of like, oh, yeah, well, you know, it'll be an experience. And sure enough, those, you know, guys got a sheep.
Oh, and
so
they?
That was a learning experience for the students. But if you're not, don't want to see that, or it's not something that it bothers you, then yeah, you definitely want to be careful where you're going.
Right. It goes both ways. Yeah. You don't want to disrupt their hunt either.
Right, exactly, for sure. And a classic example of that is the Denali Highway, mm-hmm. where, boy, you get up there when the Tier 1, you know, hunt's going on. For caribou, it can be a zoo. And that's, I pay attention to that, and I just avoid those places that have a lot of hunting activity mm-hmm. going on, unless mm-hmm. I want to go hunting, and I'll go there.
Yeah. So I've been up camping in Denali, you know, the whole system is shut down in terms of, you don't, I mean, it's much opener access, but you could also just suddenly get snow on top of you.
Yeah.
Because if you get that far north and that high up, then even late August, you can get snowed upon. And I've certainly run into very cold weather up there, and also sort of on the way up to Whitehorse, you know, that you have to be ready for some pretty darn cold weather if you're going to be out in late September, October yep. in Alaska.
Yeah, we usually recommend, and I will bring at least a 20-degree synthetic bag, sleeping bag. We even recommend 0-degree bags when we're going up on the Yukon or up farther north, which, by the way, is a stunning place. I mean, mm-hmm. there's no one up there, and it's just a really gorgeous place. If you're a birder, the birds are all migrating through upriver up the Yukon and the Tanana valleys, and so it's a pretty cool place to be. But you can all of a sudden get, and about 6 years ago, 5 or 6 years ago, we had 15-degree temperatures. Mm-hmm. So you, on the other hand, last year we were there, we were probably had 75 to 80 degrees. We actually had people heat exhaustion.
Oh,
so we're setting
crazy.
Up our teepee to put people in it, took it out of the heat, not for coolness.
That's
and
amazing.
We had people jumping in the river. So fall can be just a wide swing on temperatures,
yeah.
and you have to be prepared for it all, which means your pack, your boat, whatever, is going to be a little fuller of clear.
Yeah. It's Outdoor Explorer. We're talking about fall trips and getting out, and don't hunker down yet, right? You can save your hunkering down for November when it's like totally dark and raining all the time. And we're not even going to hope for snow early because we've been disappointed too many times. And we're talking about El Nino this year. But we are October. Take advantage of it. Don't give up on October. And my guest is Paul Tordock from Alaska Pacific University. You have kayaked in Prince William Sound every month of the year, as I recall. I've noticed that, you know, down on Ketchumak Bay, the weather patterns change late August, certainly mid-September, to where you have a day breeze, which is a sea breeze that flows onto the shore during the afternoon, and then sometime at this time of year, that just stops, and the wind directions, prevailing winds change. Mm-hmm. And you also have the potential for getting much bigger storms than you do in the summer. You really got to watch out more. What do you think about paddling like September and October out in the Sound?
Well, it is going to be wetter, and it's going to be windier. The diurnal patterns change because the land's not heating up as much. Mm-hmm. We're just losing sunlight and heat. And so the land doesn't heat up, so don't get those sea breezes, like you mentioned. Also, we start to get the remnants of these typhoons and cyclones. Mm-hmm. So the big question now is, like, what's going to happen with the one that's hitting the Philippines?
And
will that come
by the time they hear this, they will know.
Yeah, exactly. And but those can bring a lot of wetness and rain and wind. So on the other hand, I go out there, and it is stunning. I mean, the colors are amazing. In some spots, you can even find salmon once in a while.
Silvers.
In September, yep. And there's just very few people out there. Now, there are more and more people as the years go by, but still very few people. The other thing that starts to occur, the birds are migrating through, so you'll see a lot of the birds, and the sort of pelagic birds are congregating in the Sound. But as the weather gets worse, which it tends to do as we get into winter, those animals and birds that are staying around will come in toward the fjords and the bays and the passages, which is like Whittier and Valdez and Seward. So you tend to see more of that. And there's just less boat traffic to disturb them. So it's a pretty, if you get good weather, in my experience, it's almost always breezy and windy. Mm-hmm. Even on a nice day, you'll have winds from the north or from the west. So it's an intermediate skill level.
Yeah,
at least.
And there's nobody around to help. I mean, even in mid-September on Ketchumak Bay, it's like there's been a neutron bomb that's gone on and like no people.
Right, yeah.
Which strikes me always as the calendar rules, right? Because even though it was gorgeous weather down there, because it was 10 days after Labor Day, somebody's flipped a switch and nobody's allowed to be out anymore,
Yeah, well, I don't know. It could be that people, you know, use up our vacation time in the summer and we're saving it for Christmas. And so we're just...
Tourists are gone.
Visitors are gone. Mm-hmm. Just by having people that have second homes and stuff close them up and move, you know, start to get ready. And I think a lot of us are just busy getting ready for winter. Like, we're like, put off all our chores all summer. But I got this list of my to-do list in the summer. Now I got to get it done.
Yeah.
Because summer's done. So maybe that's why. I don't know.
Yeah.
But it's a fantastic time of year to be out, for sure. And I think it is a little tricky. I do think the joy of it is there are fewer people out. But the risk is that, like you said, there are fewer people around to help you. And just because the weather does get worse, it does get rainier, and with rain comes wind, and eventually snow. And you never know when that's going to happen. You know, I think last year we were having snow pretty early up in the Chugach, so you have to be prepared for all that.
Yeah, well, you can always see it from down here, like the termination dust here. And then when it comes, I assume it's just like an inch or two for the first dusting. So not big a deal.
It looks a lot, but yeah.
But you need to be careful on that Chugach sort of rock because when it's wet, it can be extremely slippery. So, sort of sticking to the trails and not going for peaks during that time of year is probably a good idea.
And I think our tendency is to think, oh, it's still summer. And we're prepared for summer. We prepared for, I got the same clothes, I got the same shoes, I got this, whatever I bring out, then all of a sudden it's not. And that can happen very, very quickly in the fall. And then you get caught. I mean, there, I think, quite a while ago, maybe 10 years ago, I remember some people being on the Resurrection Pass Trail on a low snow year, low snowfall. It just wasn't snowing. And boom, they got up 2 or 3 feet, and they had to be pulled out by helicopters.
Oh, in other words, they were up there, and
they didn't have snowshoes. They didn't have prepared for winter. They were fine, but they couldn't move. Mm-hmm. They were stuck, and they're probably at a cabin, so they were okay. But still, they couldn't move because winter came in very flat.
Yeah, right. So, what do you do with your students at this time of year? Do you take them on outdoor? Activities at this time of year?
Well, we just finished up our block. So APU has an intensive block. We do field courses. So we have courses up on the Yukon, a science course and an outdoor skills course. We had another outdoor leadership course in the Talkeetna's. We had a science course sort of going down, doing stuff at work at Aklutna and Homer. They're down at Homer, actually, I think they're back today, so forth and so on. So everybody sort of goes out in the field and does stuff, which is APU's fantastic. And this block allows us to do that. And then now they have to go to school, right? So now they have to really like come into the classroom.
It's the classroom work,
But we do have weekend and day, like our Fridays are all field days primarily. So I have a class called Human Impacts class. So we'll go out and measure stuff. So every Friday we go out, you know, people might see us up at Glen Alps doing surveys for state parks and sort of that kind of work. And about that can go through November 1st, but the big switch for me is when the time changes. Mm-hmm. Like I always go, whatever that first Sunday in November is, when they lose an hour, all of a sudden you're like, oh, I went from, okay, this is great, until all of a sudden it's dark at 5 or 5:30.
Yeah.
And that really shuts down.
I think that kind of kills you. Yeah.
And that changes the activity patterns too quite a bit.
I always find that that's when I sort of have to rethink about my workout, because I'm used to working out sort of after I'm done with my work day, and you're used to doing it in the daylight, and then suddenly it's dark and you kind of want to hunker down and not even do it.
Yeah.
And then you remember, wait a minute, it's going to be like this for another, 5 months.
Right. Yeah,
I got to just break out the headlamp and just
do
it.
Just an adjustment to get ready to be there. And there's a lot less people out when it's dark out. I mean, it is an interesting time of year, that time of year, because obviously moose are always around, but the bears can still be out. The whole bear scene is one that I sort of think, oh, it's fall now, I don't have to worry about them so much. But
climate change—they don't go down.
As early, and they tend to be around even this time of year with the moose. Like being up at Glen Alps is you really got to be on your toes up around Glen Alps in that zone, that hemlock zone where the moose are going into rut, and there's some hunts that go on up there. There's a muzzleload hunt, and the bears know all that. The moose are distracted, so there tends to be a lot of people up there. So I think it is a time of year to keep that bear alert fairly high.
Okay, extra careful. Yeah. Well, in terms of the running calendar, there's that zombie half marathon. It's around Halloween, and then it kind of thins out, right? And you sort of like maybe get ready to, hopefully you're doing something, because you're probably not going to be skiing it for a while. It's hard to keep the energy level up.
It is and isn't. I mean, I like it because, again, there's not that many people out. And it is a time I tend to like, oh, okay, I'm not skiing, I'm not really focused on that yet, so what do I do? And biking, there's single track biking's added a lot to the Anchorage Bowl, and able to
you
keep
can,
biking.
You can roller ski until there's too many dead leaves on the bike trail, right, and it becomes deadly.
Roller skiing, biking, running, get in the pool.
I have a friend who always goes up to Nancy Lakes and tries to do it the last weekend it's possible to canoe up there. Kind of break your way through the skim ice and again, you have it all to yourself.
Right.
So these are the pleasures of the fall.
And I took another big pleasure of the fall. The thing about that is, boy, the Kenai River is just empty. I love, one of the things we love to do is go down and float the Kenai in the fall and fly fish for trout. I mean, it's sort of a little annual thing we have, and there's no one on it. Leaves are beautiful. It's just a whole different place in the fall.
Yeah. Again, I've done Nancy Lakes. I've also done the Swan Lake Canoe Route in the fall. just spectacular. I mean, if you hit it when the leaves are changing, it's unbelievable how pretty it is.
Right.
And, you know, you wouldn't be swimming there anyway. It's too cold year-round. So it's just like, you know, be careful because there's nobody else out there. But yeah, get out and enjoy it.
Another interesting zone that I think we all think about driving through it, but we don't stop there, at least for Anchorage, is a Tok area. Mm. It's got some really amazing, that the river, the Tanana, flows through there. Again, it's a flyway. There's a lot of birds going through there. It's a beautiful zone, the Besna Road, as long as it doesn't wash out, which it does. It doesn't have culverts, so get a lot of rain, it floods off pretty easily. But you can, even when it's wet out, you can still get in there a bunch of miles. There's some, National Park Service has some cabins in there that are, you have to reserve them, but they're free, that are also really nice ones right off the road. Another one's a hike in up in the Metasta Mountains, but kind of sort of unexplored, unused area.
Yeah.
It's got some nice rivers, nice class one rivers, and higher, obviously, and some hiking, and can be pretty nice. So a lot of times when it's rainy in Anchorage, you're like, okay, look at the map and go, where's it going to be nice at? And you go into the interior, and it can be very nice up there.
Yeah, for sure. And that red tundra is really gorgeous. Yeah. I don't even know if everybody knows, but the tundra actually turns red for a little while until it snows.
Yeah, it's all dwarf dogwood that's turning red, and the small blueberry patches, and it's gorgeous.
Yeah, great. Well, thanks, Paul. It's always fun to have you come in and just sort of chat about what we enjoy. I don't know if anybody wants to listen to it, but...
thank you for having me.
It fills me with anticipation for getting out and enjoying some of these places.
Yeah, fall is a great time. I don't have an unfavorite season. Mm-hmm. I'm just like, maybe there's some time in early November that I could probably leave. But other than that, it's like, I really like this time of year to go off and do stuff.
So. Yeah. It's pretty, you know, if we have a nice fall and then early snow, that's ideal. And then we can get back on our skis.
Yeah.
All right.
Thanks.
Oh, thank you. Yep. Okay. It's Outdoor Explorer. Paul Twardock is a professor at Alaska Pacific University. I'm Charles Woolforth. Stay with us. Our show will continue. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth. Maybe you have had this experience. I know I have. When you're heading into the Alaska backcountry, you have to use one of those bear-proof canisters, which are kind of like large coffee cans in size and shape, and figuring out how to get your stuff in there, how to get it out. You get to your destination, and you can't remember which canister you put things in. You end up unpacking everything, and then trying to fit it into your backpack. It's just, it doesn't sound like it would be a big deal, and it really isn't, I guess. It's kind of an annoyance, but... my next guest is someone who's dealt with this innumerable times and has some tips and actually wrote a little article about it that got my attention. And so I thought we'd have her on the air to help the rest of us who have to deal with bear-proof canisters and how to make it a little bit more convenient and less difficult. Sarah Ebright is the lead guide with St. Elias Alpine Guides, and I have her on the phone from McCarthy, and we're pre-recording. It's still the summer season. In 2018, though it's drawing to a close, and Sarah just got back from a backcountry trek. And Sarah, I guess you've used these canisters for many years and probably, you know, as I said, an innumerable number of times.
Yes, that is very, very true.
Yeah. And they're super essential. I mean, you wouldn't go out without them because there's a lot of bears around, right?
Oh, absolutely. With the bear population we have out here in the Wrangells, a lot of our backpacking trips are going through terrain that has not only black bears, but also grizzly bears. And so we always have to be very careful to set up our camp appropriately and keep the food smells away from where we'll be sleeping, and then make sure at the end of the night, all of our food and anything that smells is tucked away in bear cans so that that the bears can't access it and the bears stay wild out here and more fun to be around.
Yeah, and the canisters seem like they're very... They do their job. A bear can't really get into them. But then they also create some inconvenience when you're on a backpacking trip in terms of just the fact you've got to keep your stuff in there and how are you going to access it and how are you going to pack it. So what are your sort of, to start with, when you're thinking about packing up a trip, presumably you're going to be using more than one of these things. How do you distribute your stuff, or how do you think about packing them up?
Yeah, so I mean, I kind of look at working with bear cans in two veins, and one is just packing the actual inside of the bear can full of food and trying to make sure you're using that space most efficiently. And then the other half of it is getting that bear can into your backpack and being able to pack all of your additional gear around it. So for packing items actually inside of the bear can, I like to try to pack things up in smaller bags so that you can more easily fit several smaller Ziploc bags within a bear can instead of taking a large Ziploc bag and maximizing the space in that, because then it makes it a little bit harder to fill all the nooks and crannies in your bear can. But Ziploc bags are essential just because the bear cans themselves don't limit the smells that can come out of the canister. If you have really smelly food in there, the air can still escape. And so sealing things in Ziploc bags just gives you a little bit of an extra layer of protection.
I see. So you use lots of smaller bags because the bear canister is round. It's kind of an odd shape to be packing. And if you have a larger bag, it's going to create more waste space in there.
Exactly. It creates more voids, and that's what I'm always trying to avoid, to be most efficient.
Mm-hmm. So do you spend some time planning out like when you're going to need things so that you don't have to unpack the thing every single time?
I do. When I go into a trip, I start out by making a little bit of a chart where I list the days across the top, day 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, et cetera, and then the meals along the left side, and I actually make a menu for the entire trip. And so then when I pack the food, I'll label, breakfast day 1, lunch day 6, and have it all labeled on each of the bags, and then try to stack those in that order within the bear cans. And then you can put a little duct tape and a number on each bear can so you know which one to hit first.
So it's really a matter of planning, and you've got this written out grid, and I bet you probably reuse the same grid. I know I keep one on my computer and sort of in a table and a document, and I can, if I want to change something, I can sort of erase, and type in, but always having that structure there so that you know that everything's covered. And then I had not thought of that, of writing the sort of the day and when you need it on the Ziploc. So when you put it in there, it sort of comes out in the same order. That's a great idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it makes it easy because oftentimes when you get into camp, you're pretty tired. And so anything you can do to limit the amount of thinking you have to do can be really helpful out there.
And you really only need to put the food in there, right? I mean, if you you can keep your other stuff out if it's not going to have any food odor. So the stuff that you're going to use over and over again doesn't really need to be in there, just the consumables, correct?
Correct. So my stove and pots, I just make sure that they're nice and clean and fully, dishes are fully done at the end of the night, and then I don't have to put those inside the bear cans. And so it's really just the food that I'm consuming and any toiletries that smell.
Mm-hmm. So when you're packing up a backpack, a bear can gives you this large, round, heavy shape, which it's not the most amenable to fitting into a soft backpack, where you would really prefer to have things that are flexible and can be moved around. How do you handle that?
Well, besides writing to the bear can manufacturers to see if they can create a bear can that's actually backpack shaped. But they cannot. the round shape is, I think, really important so that the bears can't get any grip on it.
I see. If it had corners, the bears would be able to bite it. Right. That makes sense.
I like to pack my bear can in the same place in my backpack every time. And personally, I don't want the weight. A bear can is really heavy with all that food. That's kind of the heaviest item in my pack. And so I don't want it far away from my center of gravity or too high that it makes me makes my backpack really top heavy. And so the spot that I found fits the best with my backpack and the equipment that I'm carrying is to put my sleeping bag horizontally in the bottom of my backpack, and then vertically right on top of that sleeping bag is where my bear can goes. So it's close to my center of gravity and not too high in the pack, and then I can pack my additional items like my dry bag of extra clothes, my sleeping pad, my med kit. I can pack those around to kind of lock that bear can into place.
I see. So it's about balance and making sure that it's close to the body, right? So that you don't have that leverage of it kind of pulling you backwards.
Mm-hmm.
How many bear cans do you need sort of per person per day on a trip? I mean, in terms of someone who's planning a trip and thinking about, like, if they need to rent them or whatever, do you have a rule of thumb?
Yeah, at least for the trips that I work up here in the Wrangles and the food that I'm typically packing for these trips, I can get one person can have 5 days worth of food in a bear can is usually the target that I can hit. If you're packing some really bulky, like pasta shapes that have a lot of airspace, then it might be bigger, but you can make little changes to try to maximize your volume. If you don't pre-slice and pre-cut up your cheese and you leave it as a block, that's, a really nice, dense, low-volume food item, or using angel hair pasta versus, penne or something with a lot of air spaces, that can really help reduce the volume that you have as well.
I see. Can you fit two of these into a backpack? I mean, you could, like, one on top of the other if you're on a longer trip?
Yes, and I will do that. I try to avoid it whenever possible because it's quite heavy. But on our longer trips, often as the guide, I will be carrying 2 bear cans, and that's exactly how I will stack them.
Yeah, and so then that gives you sort of more range for your trip.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Interesting. So did you learn all this stuff sort of by trial and error, or is it lore that's been passed down?
I know. Honestly, a lot of this I have learned by trial and error. You start out assisted guiding on a trip, and you see what your lead guide is doing, but it also, you just have to kind of do it yourself and see what system works for you and your particular backpack. So a lot of it was, making mistakes and figuring out, more comfortable ways to carry a backpack with a full bear canister in it.
Yeah. Well, that's a lot of the fun of going outdoors on this kind of trip is figuring out how you want to do it and figuring out how you're going to work your equipment and your tech and sort of developing your own style. So I appreciate you sharing yours with us, and it'd probably be really useful information for our listeners. Sarah Ebright is a lead guide with St. Elias Alpine Guides. She's joining us by phone from McCarthy. Thanks so much for being with us, Sarah.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And we will have a link to Sarah's company and an article that she wrote on this topic on our site at outdoorexplorer.org, where you can always find stuff on whatever we're talking about on the show. My name is Charles Woolforth. Stay with us.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store, or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Our next segment is from the Trail Tales Storytelling event in downtown Anchorage from Alaska Trails. We're going to hear a fall story with Birch Block talking about hunting caribou on a bicycle.
Hello. So I was asked to tell a story of a trip that we've done for, I think next year is going to be our 5th annual community bike hunt. And I just thought I'd start, the biggest story that sticks out to me is the first trip that we did out there, so I'll go back to the beginning. We did do a scouting trip the year previous, just two of us, me and my friend Gabe, and we went up to the Denali Highway. We hiked, we didn't bring bikes this time, we didn't know there were roads, we didn't know there were anything usable. So my friend Gabe and I went in for probably one of the most arduous and difficult hunts I'd ever been on. I've been hunting since I was like 10 years old. I think my dad strapped like a quarter of a moose to my back when I was 13 and just told me to walk. So we went up there, and I don't think Gabe was going to come again after this hunt, because we had gone in like 6 or 7 miles on foot walking next to this perfectly good road that would have been really nice with something that rolled. But we ended up getting a big bull caribou and splitting it between two people. And when the subsistence hunt permits were on, they require you to take out the hide, the kidneys. We took out the tongue, the brain. Like, we salvaged everything we possibly could out of this. And that's really important to us as like a subsistence group. So our packs were probably 120 pounds, which proportionally to Supermom over here maybe was not as much for body mass. But it was really hard for us to get out walking on a perfectly good bikeable road. So the next year we came back with a strong like passion. We're going to bring bikes. And most of us off the chain don't have a lot. So we were thinking like, oh my gosh, we're going to have like burly trailers and children's things that are rated to 40 pounds and they're going to all break and fall apart. And we're not going to be able to put them in. And so I tried to write some, I was on a sponsorship kick for a little minute. And we wrote, I thought like maybe the best bike company that we should try to solicit was like a really surly bike. Who's going to like do this? Who's gonna? I was like, oh, we should write Surly Bikes. They're going to do it for us. And they have these two sweet flatbeds that they sent us for totally free. They send them to the Bike Collective. And these things are rated to like 300 pounds. They're just solid steel. They're really tough. So I'm like, all right, we got step one. We got our trailers. We're going to be able to do this. So we go up. We go with a crew. We get like all the group together. We have 14 people, I think. Trade out, maybe there was even 18. And like everything, we threw together some Bob trailers in there. We had the Bills and the Teds from the Surleys. And we were packing them all into the bike trailers. We had a big flatbed in Anchorage, and we were like trying to make flatbed decks the night beforehand. We got up at 5 a.m., pitch black. We're trying to drive all the way up north, so we got hours and hours of driving. I have a unregistered trailer with no lights. I have like a really old Astro van, aptly named Disastro, that's like limping along, and is pulling the trailer with all this cargo. And I had my friend trail me the whole way just to make sure that we had some like lights and hopefully didn't get pulled over. And so there's a lot of room for error in this trip. And we get up there, we unload, we go up, and we're getting like really tired. We all thought we were in pretty good shape. We all try to bike a lot and have a lot of fun biking. But if you put 100 pounds on a trailer and you bike it uphill in a valley, it's very humbling. And we weren't in as good a shape as we thought. So we get about 6 miles, we're starting to get tired, and we were smart. We brought radios, we're like communicating with a couple of people up front, and they're like, no, there's a perfect camp, just keep coming, just keep coming. It's really close, and it wasn't that close. And we keep biking, we get there like pitch black, it's super cold, we just get set up and pass out. Next morning I wake up, there's probably, we invited a lot of people who weren't really ready to hunt, so maybe there's like, out of the 14, maybe there's like 2 people ready to hunt. And I was one of them, and maybe there's like 1 or 2 more. And then I wake up to somebody like banging on my tent, like, Birch, there's caribou on the riverbed. There's caribou on the riverbed. You gotta get up. Gotta go get them. And I woke up. There were caribou right out next to camp, just right there. And so me and another friend, we just like didn't even pack water. I don't even think I grabbed ammo. I just grabbed my gun. We just started chasing. We're like, oh, it's gonna be easy. We're gonna get them close. But if anybody's ever chased a caribou, it's never that easy. And so we probably chased them about 3 miles, no water, no extra, no pack, no nothing. And finally, we got 2. So we have 2, and we like start field dressing them. The group comes up behind us, and it's awesome to have 8 people surrounding a caribou to skin it, field dress it, get everything out, have it, start people packing out. So we get these 2 all ready to go. And as soon as we get those 2 ready to go, there's like another herd coming down the hill right after us. And so I think I have like 2 bullets left, and I'm like, I just got a drink of water from somebody. Somebody threw me a water bottle, and so I go start chasing these other herd. So we chase after those for another 2 miles. We get 1. We hike back to camp, and I'm like, okay, I'm going to go get some breakfast. It's probably 3 p.m. And I go take a nap for about 5 minutes. The other 2 designated hunters, they're off up on, they go like searching for caribou in some other valley, and somebody comes beating on my tent about 5 minutes into my nap, like, Bert, there's caribou on the riverbed. There's caribou on the riverbed. Go grab my gun, get my gun, run out, and just start going after them. This time I had my pack, though. I had some water, I had some snacks, and then found this herd another 2 miles up or so. I don't know, distances are starting to get kind of, I'm pretty exhausted, didn't sleep very good the last few nights. And then end up going up, getting up on the herd. There's a couple nice bulls in there. Shoot at one, kind of in the brush. Didn't see where it landed, and then they came out again, shot at another one I thought was the same one, and I walked up and had 2 more. So now I got 2 caribou. It's like not even 12 hours, and I've hunted caribou a long time since I was really young. I don't think I've ever seen this many caribou. Like 5 in 1 day is kind of out of control, and I was just like, what did I get myself into? This is ridiculous. So we start field dressing those. Some more people from the group show up, help us field dress them. We get them down. Luckily, somebody's like brought one of the big flatbed Surly trailers right to the road, so we don't have to pack in the last mile. They run them down to camp. We've got 5 caribou on the meat pole. we all go to bed. I think the northern lights were out real good, but I didn't see them. And then next morning, same thing. Somebody's beating on my tent. Birch, there's caribou on the riverbed. There's caribou on the riverbed. I'm like, oh my goodness. All right. I know the other two designated hunters are in camp. I'm sleeping. I'm going to get breakfast. You two, what is it? Alan, Gabe, you guys go get those caribou. And so they go after them. I hear two gunshots in my bed. I'm like, oh, I guess I better get out of bed. So we got like, then we got seven caribou on the meat pole. Those are right in camp too. So everybody got to be around. Everybody got to help out. And then now I'm thinking like, oh my goodness, how many pounds we got? Seven. That's probably 800, 900 pounds of stuff we got to move. And we haven't tested it on any of these trailers yet. We're like, is this going to work? This is probably a bad time to start thinking about those thoughts. So we start loading things up, and like just as we're leaving, I think we had a total of 8 tags total that year to bring up there. And as soon as we're leaving, we hear one more gunshot, and we're like, oh no. 8 caribou on the meat pole. So we start loading them, and actually things go pretty well. So I'll plug Surly a little bit. They got pretty good trailers. And we started hauling stuff out. We had some reinforcements. We had our friends Kendra, Will, Kate, Carp came to help us out. And they were all bike packing super light, so they were feeling pretty good by the time they got to camp that day. They did a load. I think it took about 2 days to run all this stuff out. And then put it all in the freezer, cut it all up, spread it amongst the group. And since then, we had a raging success, I guess, kind of. But since then, we've put up, the last 4 years, 2,644 pounds of caribou. They went to over 60 households, and we donated hundreds of pounds to Otna tribal offices whose ancestral lands we were hunting on. And we hauled every bit of it out to the trailhead by bike power. And I just want to say that also that would not have been possible without there being a designated non-motorized area. I want to emphasize how important that was in like our success and the success of lots of other people. I like to see those continue and let's like break the dominant paradigm of motorized hunting and let's go back to foot and human power. And I think we need those areas, especially the Denali Highway area, the Clearwater Controlled Use Area is being threatened by a lot of new trail development, and they're trying to push to lower the size of it, smaller and smaller. So it'd be nice to see that not get reduced in size, and I'd like to see closer areas so we don't have to drive 5 hours to get to a non-motorized area and closer to home. So I think a lot can happen to this. I think if people stay creative and people look at a lot of options, we can go out and we can harvest and we can subsist without turning gasoline into noise more. So. Yeah.
That was Birch Block speaking at Trail Tales, the event put on by Alaska Trails. We'll have another story coming up a little later, and you can find out more about that event at our site, outdoorexplorer.org. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. So something that is always feels very sad to me is when autumn comes and I'm putting my boat away, and I have this feeling that boating is over for the year, and since it's just about my favorite thing to do, it feels very sad. But I got a press release from the Coast Guard Auxiliary talking about boating safety classes that are available that kind of can keep your season going and maybe make you a better boater and make you safer and perhaps even enjoy it more. And besides all that, kind of, you still get to talk about it, right? It's still that fun topic in your life, even if the boat is under a tarp. So to talk about that, right now I've got Doris Thomas, who's Public Affairs Officer with the Coast Guard Auxiliary in Alaska. Coast Guard Auxiliary is a volunteer organization that supports safety in the water. And I asked Doris to come in and talk about the classes that they have. There's classes being offered in various communities, right, Doris?
Yes, the auxiliary has flotillas, which is the smallest unit of the auxiliary, in 10 Alaska communities. And several of them have classes coming up this fall.
And why do you do it in the fall? Because everybody's out boating in the summer, right?
That's right. Our members are out boating, and so are most of our potential students.
Right, right. So why would somebody need to take a class?
Generally, a person takes a class because they want to know more about safe boating. Sometimes they've gotten themselves in trouble and realize that they need a class. That's how my husband and I got started almost 40 years ago. We had some little mishaps with our first canoe and decided maybe we ought to know a little bit more.
Yeah, especially in Alaska, you know, because if you fall in the water or you have trouble, it's a big deal. It's not like you're boating on a lake in the lower 48 and you can just swim.
Yes, most accidents in Alaska have a lot to do with the cold water and somebody falling in the water and not being able to get out of it and not being able to be rescued.
Mm-hmm. Now, some of the stuff is, I guess, obvious that you should not drink when you're boating, that you should wear a PFD. But there's a lot of other stuff about boat operations that's not so obvious. And it's not necessarily simple. I mean, you need to learn some stuff to be safe out in the water.
Yes, you need to know which equipment to have, how to get help if you have an accident, who to report it to if you have an accident, just some basic things about how much fuel do you take.
Yeah, do you cover boat handling and how to manage, say, towing and other situations of that kind?
We cover pretty much everything, depending on which class you're taking. Some of them are more in-depth. Some of them are just, you know, 4 to 6 hours. But we try to cover as much as we can in the time allotted for the particular class.
Mm-hmm. Is there any kind of certification or benefits that come in terms of insurance or anything like that?
Most insurance companies will give a discount for somebody who's completed a class. It depends on the company, of course.
Okay. So how long does it? You said, sounds like you've got different lengths of classes. Why don't you give me sort of the curriculum or what you cover and how long each one takes?
There's a boating skills and seamanship course, and that one started September 18th in Anchorage, and I believe they can still take late students if they're willing to do the catch up work. That one's a 9-week class, meets once a week. They cover pretty much everything. It's very comprehensive. Eagle River is offering a shorter course starting October 3rd. That meets for 2 Saturday mornings, October 3rd and the 10th. I'm sorry, October 6th and 13th. And then that will cover a little bit less than the longer course, but you would get everything from trailering your boat, the equipment you need, pretty comprehensive look at all the things that a boater would need to know to get on the water.
Mm-hmm. Do anything down on the Kenai Peninsula?
Kenai's having a couple of short courses. These are more like seminars, about 4 hours long. They have your boat's radio on September 28th and GPS for mariners on the 29th.
Okay. And it sounds like the focus is mostly on the kind of boating we have here, which is tends to be small motorboats that go on trailers rather than like, it's not about operating a big, huge yacht or something.
The courses are geared for all sorts of boaters, everybody from somebody on a paddle boat to a small motorboat.
Okay. And tell me about the organization itself, the auxiliary. What is it exactly?
It's an all-volunteer organization. We will be celebrating our 80th anniversary next year. It was founded in 1939.
Wow.
By the Coast Guard to improve recreational boating safety. That's our main focus, is to keep boaters safe out there. And there's about 24,000 members nationally and about 200 in Alaska.
Okay. And so these courses are taught by your members?
All volunteers, yep.
Wow. That's a pretty nice service for you to do for the community, because that's a lot of work to teach a class like that.
Well, thank you. It's very rewarding. We're always looking for new members.
Okay. Any cost for the courses?
The courses range from about $25 to around $50, depending on which flotilla is giving it and what their overhead is.
Yeah, that seems reasonable. So if folks want to get involved as members, I guess probably come to a course first and then talk to one of the instructors about volunteering?
That's a good way to start.
Yeah, yeah. So we will have links to this information on our website at outdoorexplorer.org if people want to find it. Any other ways that they can get in touch with you?
One of the easiest ways is, if you can go looking for a boating course, is to go to cgaux.org And there's a link on there. You can click on the button that says find a boating course and put in your zip code, and voila, you will find out where the courses are.
So that'll work for any time, yeah.
Yep.
Great. Well, thank you. Doris Thomas is the Public Affairs Officer for the Coast Guard Auxiliary in Alaska. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Stay tuned as Outdoor Explorer continues. Our last segment today comes from Trail Tales. Cody talked about freedom from failure and learning lessons to pick yourself back up after you've crashed or failed and push on to try again.
So I've been pretty fortunate over the last many, many years to have ridden my bike in some pretty amazing places around the world and meet some pretty incredible people. I've been a racer, I've been a coach, I've been a builder, I've been just an everyday rider. I've raced cross-country, enduro, downhill, I've ridden fat bikes, road bikes, and even last year I did a cross race. That was a first for me. But throughout all of that, there's one thing that has remained pretty constant, and that's crashing. So my earliest memory of biking, my very first memory of biking is I was 4 years old and I was standing on top of our driveway and I had my shiny little red BMX bike. It was a beautiful sunny day. And I did what any four-year-old boy would do. And I looked my mom straight in the eyes and I pointed that bike straight downhill. And so about halfway down the driveway is when the speed wobbles kicked in and that bike was shimmying side to side. And you know, at this point, I was committed, mainly because at 4 years old, I hadn't quite figured out braking yet. But regardless, that bike is shimmying out of control, I'm gaining speed, and all of a sudden, that bike folds underneath me like a cheap suit. And I get catapulted into the air, and I am sailing through the air like Superman for a brief second until, splat, I'm pasted across the pavement, I'm ragdolling down the driveway until I come to a halt in this bruised and bloodied, tangled heap. My dad's running down the driveway. My mom is screaming, oh, my baby! And that moment right there was when my love affair with biking started. And, you know, my friends are great. They'll be the first to tell you that if it's got wheels, skis, or a throttle, I've crashed it without fail. And some people say I'm an adrenaline junkie or that I'm a little bit crazy. Some people say I've had a few too many hits to the head or I've lacked self-preservation. I blame faulty equipment. Whatever the reason, I crash a lot. So, now my dad. My dad's a quiet man who tends to speak more through actions than words. But every once in a while, he'll roll out a little pearl of wisdom, a little gem, and he's had a few over the years. A personal favorite of mine was when he told me, son, if you're gonna be stupid, you better be tough. So 15-year-old Cody thinks that he's got a really good idea. And I steal my dad's motorcycle. And we lived out in the country, so I took that motorcycle for a joyride, about 10, 15 miles, and I was having a great time. And I was home free. I could see the house. It was maybe a quarter mile up the driveway. Remember what I said about wheels, throttles? I hit a patch of gravel, laid the bike down, flipped it into the field, totaled it, just laying there in the field, picking myself up, stood that bike back up. And as I was pushing my dad's motorcycle back to the house, I realized that while I most certainly was stupid, I definitely was not tough. If you want to see tough, I'm just saying. Now, a more poignant life lesson that my dad taught me, he taught me that day in the driveway as I lay in a tangled little heap. And what he taught me was that when we fall, we get back up. Now, my parents never pretended that life didn't have hardships or challenges, but what they did instill in my brothers and I was that was more, what was more important in life was how we rose to meet those challenges and facing them head on and learning and growing with them. And I can't think of a sport that has more direct application of that than mountain biking. I mean, after all, I've been crashing my bike and picking myself up out of the dirt for 30 years now. This sport is a roller coaster. I mean, not just the trails like are fun like a roller coaster. I mean, it's an emotional roller coaster. It's frustrating and exasperating and terrifying and humbling and just, I finished rides just so defeated and demoralized and discouraged that all you want to do is just sell your bike and be done with it. And then you have that one moment where something just clicks. It all comes together. And all of a sudden that trail that section of trail that you've had to walk every time, all of a sudden you blast right through it. Or that hill you've never been able to climb, you clean it. Or that jump that's always been too big, you send it. And all of a sudden you're filled with excitement and exhilaration and joyfulness and the sense of accomplishment. And all the frustration and agony and pain and struggle that it took to get there, it just melts away. And you're filled with this fire and this desire to tackle something new and take on another challenge. And all of a sudden that trail that was too hard, well, maybe it's not today. And that jump that's too big, or that drop that's too high, or that distance that was too far, well, maybe not. And now this sport has taught me a lot of things. It's taught me perseverance and dedication, commitment and drive, patience, and a whole lot of humility. But probably the most valuable thing that this sport has taught me is it's shifted how I choose to look at failure. And I truthfully don't even look at it as failure anymore. All those missteps, mistakes, setbacks, and derailments, they're just steps on a path to success. And I may not be successful today, but I can try again tomorrow. And the day after that. And the day after that. Until one day I might actually succeed. And accepting that failure in reality are the opportunities in life where we learn and grow the most has allowed me to face new challenges, try new things, and do things that absolutely terrify me, like this. It's helped me face the unpredictable chaos of life in a way that allows me to be confident and truly believe that I can do it. And it all started in that driveway 30 years ago, laying in a tangled heap when my dad taught me that when we fall, we get back up.
That was Cody Gowie speaking at Trail Tales from Alaska Trails. You can learn more about them and that event through our site at outdoorexplorer.org, where you'll also find links for all the topics on today's show. And that's all we've got for you today. I want to thank Paul Tordock from Alaska Pacific University, Sarah Ebright, the lead guide with St. Elias Alpine Guides, Birch Block, who spoke at Trail Tales as well, and Doris Thomas from the Coast Guard Auxiliary. Our producer is Eric Bork. Assistant producer is Hannah Duro. My name is Charles Wolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.